belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our...
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Stacey Lynn. It's the afternoon now in Gaza, and sometime today, a third round of hostages are expected to be released. We are now hearing an American may be among them. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan on CBS's Face the Nation.
We have been in close touch with the Israeli authorities, with Qatar, with Egypt, and we do have reason to believe that there will be an American release today, but let's wait and see what actually happens, because, of course, we are dealing with a terrorist group here, and we can't immediately trust. We have to verify.
After hostages are released, they're taken to various hospitals for extensive exams.
We will keep them here at the Edmund Hillel Safra Children's Hospital for as long as they need and care for them, help them in their preparation of coming back to their communities.
A whole lot of money was spent on Black Friday and then more on Small Business Saturday. Reporter Sharday Brown is in Sacramento.
From African-inspired clothing to food to art, this isn't just a shopping event during the holiday festivities. It's a culture and lifestyle. Inspired by the legacy of Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma, organizers say the 7th annual Shop Black Friday event in Sacramento celebrates the need for the Black community to be more self-sufficient and to support seasoned entrepreneurs.
And while the past few shopping days have been big, online spending is driving the sales. And that's going to continue tomorrow on Cyber Monday. As millions continue to shop or head home from their holiday destinations, how is Mother Nature cooperating? Rich Otto with the National Weather Service says it is messy in some areas.
We have a storm system that's moving through the center of the country that's bringing some wintry weather to portions of the plains, and it's going to be moving into some of that snow is going to be moving into the Midwest and Great Lakes later on today.
The Pope skipped his weekly Sunday appearance at St. Peter's Square.
Oggi non posso cacciarmi.
Telling the faithful earlier, he's under the weather with lung inflammation. He is still scheduled to travel to Dubai this week for the UN Climate Change Conference. A LeBron James Museum is up in his hometown of Akron, Ohio. James' mother, Gloria.
We are very proud of our foundation. Also, the fact that it helps so many people in our community, like, immediately.
The museum includes a replica of the apartment he grew up in, as well as memorabilia. All the proceeds from the museum will be used by the James Foundation to give back to the community. This is CBS News.
Make the hiring process work for you. With Indeed's end-to-end hiring solution, you can attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Start at Indeed.com/credit.
It's a wonderful Waukesha tradition and kicks off the holiday season. The 60th annual Christmas parade is Sunday, December 3rd.
Hi, I'm Don Brown.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. When federal policymakers advanced another temporary government budget, they also extended the recently expired farm bill. Farmers are breathing a sigh of relief, but advocates say ag concerns need focus and more support. Mike Moan has more.
The Farm Bill sets spending levels for agricultural and food assistance programs every 5 years. The 2018 version expired earlier this fall, and lawmakers are now finalizing a year-long extension. Mike Lavender of the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition says they shouldn't wait the full year to adopt the new Farm Bill, noting the 2018 version came with limitations.
The 2018 Farm Bill, for example, decreased investment in some of the conservation practices and conservation programs that we know are key to building resilience, but also incredibly popular among farmers.
To deal with rising threats from climate change, his group says Congress should include new investments in the new version by early 2024. Last year's Inflation Reduction Act did bolster farm conservation funding, but Republicans have been trying to strip those provisions. Meanwhile, Lavender wants more priority given to strengthening regional offices that help farmers and ranchers sign up for sustainability incentives and other aid.
How are we making sure that USDA programs and Farm Bill programs are accessible to all farmers and that we have a level playing field? Because we don't have that right now.
Lavender worries about historically disadvantaged farmers and younger producers who don't come from a farming family being able to access support like crop insurance. He acknowledges the need for more staffing and enhanced training at resource centers. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Carrie Bell.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. It's your hometown radio. Refresh.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw.
Cloudy this afternoon with snow likely. High of 33, southwesterly winds 8 to 15 miles an hour. Chance for snow showers tonight, 17. 1 to 2 inches of snow today.
For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Eric Height. Currently, it's 27 degrees.
Waukesha, home of Les Paul, our awesome farmers market, and The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media. WAUK.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. You don't know me, but I'm your brother. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. It is Saturday, November 25th, 2023. This is the 73rd broadcast of our show this morning. Every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. and a second segment at 10 a.m. as well. We're broadcasting you from throughout the state of Wisconsin from Waukesha, the Civic Media stations nation statewide. And yes, in part, some folks from around the country as well. This is our weekly review, our analysis, our discussion of those most important news stories that are animating law, government, and the aspiration for justice in America. Thank you for joining me this morning. As always, I am joined by my exceptional producer, Anya. She is here with me in our Waukesha studios, and we are taking your calls this hour and next hour as well. Your calls, your questions, especially your inquiries about the subjects on our aggressive but achievable syllabus this morning. Always taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. That number once again, 844-967-2789. Or you can go on the app, the Civic Media app, the website, find your particular broadcast station, pull down the folder for Morning Cannoli, and you will find us. Send us some notes, Anya and I, delighted to have your questions, your comments during the course of the broadcast this morning. As always, hopefully, our broadcast this morning will be informative and perhaps even inspiring to you. We always ask three important questions. Number one, what happened? What are the facts? What do we know about what's going on in America, in our world this past week, and in days far past as well? Second, why are those events important? What is significant about them? What's relevant? What is material to our lives? And third, what, if anything, can and should we do about those things? What are the legitimate reactions to them, the answers, the responses that we should make to those important things happening in our lives, our livelihoods, affecting all of us on the face of this planet, especially in our nation, the United States of America? This Saturday morning, as always, we do have a syllabus and agenda that is chock full of important information, also important insights and perspectives on the world around us. We're going to begin this morning with a special tribute, recognizing the amazing, wonderfully inspiring life of Rosalind Carter, who passed not too long ago. We're going to chat about her life a bit, and then we're going to move into some issues related to voting rights in particular, something significant coming out of one of the appeals courts just this past week, having to do with the future of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, a subject matter we have talked about a lot on this broadcast. I'm going to make reference once again to the South Carolina case pending before the United States Supreme Court, and then come right back here to Wisconsin and talk a bit about that major case pending right now before our own state Supreme Court, having to do with district line drawing. What happened just this past Monday, the 21st? What kind of oral argument did the members of our Supreme Court entertain? What's the focus of that case? What can we take away? Can we read anything from the oral argument when it comes to what the Supreme Court will decide with respect to our state district lines drawn a couple of years ago and the impact the decision may have upon the 2024 election here in our state, but also throughout the nation? I'm going to go back and do a little bit of updating when it comes to those pending matters related to the First Amendment and the rights of a criminal defendant. This one happens to be running for the presidency of the United States of America. Some so-called gag orders that have been imposed, some appellate review of those coming out of both the D.C. appellate court and also a New York appellate court. They're wrestling right now with whether or not the lower courts, the trial courts, when it imposed some restrictions on the capacity of the defendant, Donald Trump, to make statements outside of court about proceedings inside of court and the players in those trials, whether those First Amendment implications are real, wrestling with those issues at the appellate court levels, both the state and the federal system. Then we're going to also go back and tell you a little bit more about other things happening with other trials in America. Then spending, as we always do, most of our second hour on the morning broadcast, talking once again about the United States Supreme Court. Some major things happening once again this coming week. Some major oral arguments. We'll tell you about some of those things in greater and lesser degrees and focus, as we have in the past, upon one particular area of Supreme Court interest this particular term, the 2023-2024 term. This one having to do with legitimacy, the constitutionality, the activities, the very rightness, if you will, of our many federal agencies out there. A major issue having to do with what's sometimes called the administrative state. What are our agencies doing, and should the courts be involved in reviewing those decisions of fact finders, scientists, the people who have expertise in the particular areas of those agencies? What is the relationship between courts and our federal agencies when it comes to decision making by those administrative units? We're going to talk about some cases pending before the Supreme Court, one of its major focuses in this particular term. All of that coming up in the second hour this morning of our broadcast. Stay with us throughout in that entire discussion, including, once again, your phone calls, questions, and comments at 844-967-2789. Always taking your phone calls here on our morning broadcast. Let us begin in recognition of this spectacular life of a woman in our national history. Her name is Rosalynn Carter. For nearly 80 years, as we all know, the Carters, former President Jimmy Carter and his formidable and inspiring wife, Rosalynn, formed one of the longest, closest, and arguably most productive high-level political partnerships in American history. Arguably even more important and more seamless than that between Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt or Bill and Hillary Clinton, because it lacks some of the personal drama of those marriages, if you will. The secret, they said, to a long and happy marriage, both Rosalynn said this, Jimmy Carter said this as well, was to spend some time apart. That, according to their own recollections, their own memories of their lives together. They did everything from learning to read the Bible in Spanish before going to bed at night, to dodging gunfire in Africa after his presidency, and even fly fishing in Serbia when he was 90 and she was 88. They were married. The two of them were married for 77 years. 77 years. That's a distinction that's enjoyed by an estimated 1,000 or so American couples. But fascinatingly, they knew each other virtually from the day that they were born. How many of us knew this story? They met, believe it or not, a few days after Rosalynn Carter was born. She was born Rosalynn Smith way back in 1927. And they met when Jimmy's mother, his mother, who was the nurse who delivered Rosalynn at that time, brought her young toddler, Jimmy, to see the new baby. They met quite literally days after Rosalynn was born. That was their first meeting at the time. Their first date, 1945, much later, of course. Jimmy was a midshipman at the U.S. Naval Academy at the time. They went to a movie that neither one of them could remember. But nearly half a century later, Jimmy wrote a poem titled Rosalynn, remembering those first times and the dates with her. Mr. Carter, our president, said that he would not have won his long-shot 1976 bid for the presidency. He was serving as the governor, of course, of Georgia at the time. Without her charm, he said, without her hard work and her smart advice. She spent, among other things, about 75 astonishing days, 75 days campaigning in Florida alone, where she proved quite instrumental, quite pivotal in helping him to prevail in the historic primary there, which basically launched his presidential campaign legitimacy of that, his victory coming over George Wallace at the time, and marking the end, at least at that time, to a lot of the racist tendencies in that part of our nation. When Mrs. Carter, Rosalynn Carter, was our first lady, had her own professional staff, one of the first ladies to do that, a professional policy staff. She was much committed, an unprecedented role at the time as her husband's, the president's personal envoy, forcefully confronted authoritarian heads of state in Latin America and their human rights abuses. Yes, that's Rosalynn Carter, 1977 to 1981, doing that. She took action to combat age discrimination by working closely with Congressman Claude Pepper to loosen the rules on mandatory retirement, affecting the careers of millions and millions of Americans. All of this, Rosalynn Carter, when she was our first lady. I'm touched by the plight of Vietnamese boat people at the time who were fleeing communist Vietnam at the time. She helped persuade her husband to do more than double the number of refugees admitted from Southeast Asia. She was pivotal in doing all of that. And sure enough, Jimmy Carter, our former president, one-term president, but I think one of the finest, most decent men to occupy the White House in American history, described their relationship as like one person acting in concert. Those are Jimmy Carter's words. He was asked once about his decision-making strategy. Who did he bring into the fold, if you will, to make decisions? And he confirmed that his judgments on many things were animated by a number of people, and those included Cy, that was Cyrus Vance, his Secretary of State, Zbigniew Brzezinski, his National Security Advisor, Hamilton Jordan, his Chief of Staff, and yes, indeed, Rosalynn, who was, of course, the First Lady, his spouse. At the time of the revelation of that involvement, her intimate involvement, including attending cabinet meetings, Hugh Seide wrote in 1979, note the order of that often Rosalynn had the last say about those, among those folks, about the decisions made by the president on major issues, among other things. She pushed hard to have her spouse, the president, appoint more women to important positions as he did in the federal government at that time. He named five times as many women to the federal bench, the federal judiciary, district court, appellate court positions as all of his predecessors combined to that time. Five times as many women at that time. She was sometimes known as a Steel Magnolia, a nickname that, believe it or not, she actually liked. And again, she set off some controversy at the time by attending cabinet meetings, but she was dogged in her beliefs, focusing on many, many things important to her as a part of her role as her first lady. We know as well that along the way, Mrs. Carter was hugely influential in the 1980 election. When we come back after this brief break, I'm going to tell you more about that in memory of Rosalynn Carter this morning on our Saturday broadcast. Stay with us for that important discussion, reminiscing about a great American in our history, continues to influence our lives to this day.
This is the Shaw WAUK. Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin. This includes a commitment to news. Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show,
I'm not even clear from conflicting headlines whether or not Robin Voss has the cojones to move forward with impeachment against Megan Wolf. Why would he do such a thing? You know, just a couple of weeks after he said he wasn't going to do such a thing. Well, he's been threatened, huh? By what? A group headed by his primary opponent, Adam Steed.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 till 6 on your local civic media. You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
We are back here on the Saturday morning broadcast, spending appropriately some discussion this morning, some time in memory of Rosalynn Carter, this fantastic, transcendent First Lady of ours back in the 1970s, in particular 1976 to 1977 and 1981. And I will tell you that I had a special connection, a small one, admittedly, as do many Americans with Rosalynn Carter. I had the great honor, the great privilege of serving as, yes, a very young intern in the Carter White House in the summer of 1980. It was during the time of the campaign. It was 4 years after the president had taken the oath of office. Again, I think to this day, one of the most decent and remarkable human beings to occupy that White House, and also one of the most accomplished presidents, sometimes understated, undervalued in terms of our nation's history as we look back at that period of time, among other things, focusing a lot on energy policy, other things ensuring the longevity and lifeblood of our nation. I remember on many occasions serving as an intern in the domestic policy staff of the White House. My boss was a woman named Erica Ward, and she was the domestic policy advisor to the president at the time, often invited us over to the West Wing and to the South Lawn of the White House for various events. I recall in particular an event having to do with energy policy. The president was signing a major piece of legislation at that time, again in the summer of 1980, even in the midst of the campaign to continue to remain in the White House. And Mrs. Carter, Rosalynn Carter, ever the gracious and intellectually acute, bright, wonderfully diplomatic First Lady that she was, engaging some of us in conversation. We were thrilled, of course, perhaps even more thrilled, with due respect to the president, more thrilled to be in conversation with her than even Jimmy Carter, this spectacular human being serving as our president at the time. Thoughtful, engaging, making him a point to talk to the young people on the South Lawn of the White House at the time of what was going on. Had many other occasions to see her, of course, and to see their young daughter, Amy, skating, quite literally, with her skates on the South parking lot, if you will, the area just beyond the South portico of the White House. A wonderful marriage that they had, a wonderful human being. And we look forward to a time when she gets her proper due, although a lot of memorials are acknowledging her accomplishments to this time. A proper due both for her and Jimmy Carter in the history of our nation, sometimes overlooked for the greatness of both of them in making change in America that stays with us to this day. Along the way, of course, after the election of Ronald Reagan in November of 1980, left the White House. And undeniably, both Mrs. Carter, Rosalynn Carter, and the president were both, as they described, oppressed, somewhat rejected by the rejection of them, if you will, by the American population. And they decided to make a run at something perhaps even more spectacular than the presidency, which is changing the face of the planet, if you will. They traveled the globe together, as I indicated in our first segment. They waged peace, and indeed they established the Carter Center in Plains, Georgia, this very modest place where they have lived, and now Rosalynn Carter died in hospice just this past week. They decided to ensure that the legacy that they began in the White House from 1977 to 1981 would not end with the presidency. And indeed, during the course of the years that followed, this is a man with his spouse, the First Lady, not just at his side, but oftentimes her leading the force, if you will, around the globe, building homes, of course, here in this nation, but also waging peace overseas in the Middle East, global health initiatives, building homes all around the world for people of impoverished statuses, providing fellowships for journalists, covering mental health issues, one of those issues very important to Rosalynn Carter. and the founder of the Rosalind Carter Institute for Journalists, for caregivers who did as much to popularize a concept that barely had a name until the 1980s, focusing an awful lot, not only on the importance of journalism, but especially the importance of caregivers for people who are suffering from various mental illnesses. She had an 8-decade love affair with her spouse, Jimmy Carter, the President of the United States of America. One of the significant things that was a part of the history here is that she shared one of her husband's letters when he was out at sea from 1949. Said this way. He wrote back to Mrs. Carter. He said, when I have been away from you this long, I feel lonely and lost. And it seems that I am not really living, but just waiting to live again when you are with me again. Rosalind Carter, our spectacular first lady, she kept those letters in a drawer just adjacent to her bed until the day she died, 1 week ago. Rosalind Carter, a monumental figure in American history, we are diminished in her loss. We continue now to talk today about contemporary issues, things animated, frankly, in many ways by the decisions made by presidents past and certainly current as well, having to do with the federal courts. Just this past week, a major decision coming out of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. That is this Eighth Circuit, kind of a sprawling area of states just to the west of us here in Wisconsin, going all the way down to Arkansas, all the way up to Minnesota. Huge area, a swath of American land, of territory. The appeals court took a case out of Arkansas, the district court there, and made a decision on Monday of this past week to dramatically weaken the Voting Rights Act of 1965. What did they do in particular? They issued a ruling. This is a 3-judge panel, which is significant, a 3-judge panel that would effectively bar private citizens, non-government officials, and civil rights groups from filing lawsuits under a central provision, which we've talked about, Section 2 of the Civil Rights Act of 1965. Section 2 is this core notion that it has been illegal, not only under the Constitution, the 14th Amendment guaranteeing equal protection for people of all races, but also under the statute, guaranteeing that people of all races have access to the polls. That's a fundamental principle set forth in Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. This ruling just 6 days ago, made by the U.S. Court of Appeals, the Eighth Circuit, found that only the federal government, only the U.S. Department of Justice, yes, U.S. attorneys' offices, could bring a legal challenge under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. That, again, this crucial elemental portion of the law that prohibits election or voting practices that discriminate against Americans based on race. That's the fundamental notion behind the Voting Rights Act, stripping away, according to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, the right of private citizens, the remedy invoked by most Americans when they are petitioning under this particular notion that everyone should have access to voting rights in America. The great number of voting rights cases not brought by the U.S. Department of Justice because of resources, most of them brought by private citizens in our nation up to this point. That opinion restricting dramatically, a real kick, a real diminution in the Voting Rights Act of 1965, almost certainly be appealed to the Supreme Court, again, coming out of the Eighth Circuit. And we will see what the impact of that is. But right now, the Eighth Circuit making this major decision having to do with the future of the Voting Rights Act. Now, a couple of things could happen here. One is they could have an en banc hearing. What is the en banc hearing? That would be a hearing among all of the judges of the Eighth Circuit. This is just a 3-judge panel, all of them reviewing this decision. And when we come back, I'll tell you about the other thing that could happen. The other thing that could happen in this term of the United States Supreme Court coming up right after this very big break here on our morning broadcast.
There comes a day when I'll be the one you'll see. It's gonna be me.
Whether you're heading down Les Paul Parkway or fighting traffic on the interstates, this is The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
CBS News Brief. An American is among the hostages expected to be released at some point today by Hamas. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan told Face the Nation,
"We're going to stay cautious. We're going to stay focused on getting every element of this in place. And then when an American comes across that border and into safety, we can all celebrate together."
Holiday shopping season is in full swing. Here's CBS's Elise Preston.
While in-person shopping is seeing a major jump, Cyber Monday sales are still expected to hit a record high, with many making purchases on their phones.
As people head home for their holiday destinations, part of the country is dealing with some wet and messy weather. The outlook today from Rich Otto from the National Weather Service.
Generally for Sunday, temperatures of about 10 to 20 degrees below the late November averages from the Intermountain West into much of the Great Plains and portions of the Midwest.
CBS News Brief. I'm Stacy Lynn.
Badgers run past Minnesota. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Wisconsin Badgers finally went back to their roots, the running game, and won back the Paul Bunyan axe over Minnesota. The final, Badgers 28, Minnesota 14. Luke Fickell on his players' effort.
I haven't felt it since Purdue. After that, I don't know that I had felt that energy from that position in particular. It's had some games, and if I've got the biggest smile on my face, it's because of that. It's because of the line of scrimmage. It's because of the ability to pound it and wear somebody down.
Wisconsin running back Braylon Allen rushed for 167 yards and two touchdowns. Minnesota head coach P.J. Fleck.
Well, he's really good because he is an elite back. If you hit him high, it doesn't make it bounce. You bounce off like a bowling ball. I mean, just boom, boom. He just... However, you know, we're playing some guys right now that are getting some of their first experience at a very young age. But that's really what it was. It was a lot of missed tackles.
That's Minnesota head coach P.J. Fleck with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Here's your updated forecast on The Shaw. Cloudy this afternoon with snow likely. High of 33, southwesterly winds 8 to 15 miles an hour. Chance for snow showers tonight, 17. 1 to 2 inches of snow today. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Derek Height. Currently, it's 27 degrees.
Why choose Weikert Realtors? Because your community is our community. We're your neighbors, your students, your chefs, your soldiers, your builders, your actors, your musicians, and your radio personalities. We love this city as much as you do, and that's why we want to help you live your best life here. Because we are your realtors. Call us today and let us help you find your next home. 608-821-7002 or visit Weikert-LakePoint.com. Weikert Realtors Lake Point, a home for all.
Hi, I can help whoever's
there. Cooper's Overnight Shipping Company has to deliver the goods.
Ship these gifts to your grandkids.
They need a logistics manager to keep the wheels turning.
126 packages going to Toronto, Tuscaloosa, Montreal, and Minneapolis. Oh, boy.
Indeed can help them hire great people fast.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do. Instant Match instantly connects you with quality candidates whose resumes on Indeed match your sponsored job description. Visit Indeed.com/credit and get $75 towards your first sponsored job. Terms and conditions apply.
Be a part of the resistance. Check out The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson, Monday nights at 7 on The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM WAUK, and on the Civic Media app.
The Green Bay Packers call Lambeau Field home, but did you know the stadium has a history all its own? It started with where to build it. Residents on both sides of the city wanted it. Officials argued there had to be room for growth. Eventually, farmland was purchased, but in Ashwaubenon. The bargaining continued, and in 1956, the land was annexed to Green Bay. Green Bay City Stadium became a reality the following year and was renamed in honor of team co-founder and coach Curly Lambeau in 1965. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Ball. Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
Broadcasting to Waukesha at 101.1 FM. Broadcasting to Southeast Wisconsin at 540 AM. This is The Shaw, WAUK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's some kind of love. It's some kind of fire.
We are back on our Saturday morning broadcast talking once again about voting rights in America, principally because of this decision coming out of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals just this past week, finding once again that Section 2 does not mean what it says, according to the Eighth Circuit. The text of that, the Court of Appeals finding that the Voting Rights Act of 1965 did not explicitly contain language for a private right of action, a private right of individuals to sue apart from the government itself, or the right of private citizens to file lawsuits under the law generally. And so the court finding in its opinion, this three-judge panel, that the right to sue would effectively lie with the government alone, only the U.S. Department of Justice, only U.S. attorneys being able to do that. The debate comes out of an Arkansas decision, and a decision in particular rendered by Judge Lee Radofsky. He's a district judge, a federal district judge in eastern Arkansas, and he found that only the Attorney General of the United States may bring suit to enforce Section 2. The decision, of course, was appealed to the Eighth Circuit, leading to this 2-1 ruling coming out of the three-judge panel of just this past week. A lot of people looking at this and thinking this is just the latest attack, if you will, upon Voting Rights Act principles in America. Certainly, it follows an interesting path in recent years. We recall well the case in Shelby County that basically eviscerated a major portion of the Voting Rights Act, Sections 4 and 5, the pre-clearance procedure that we've talked about a lot in this program. It followed a case called Brnovich coming out of the state of Arizona many, many years ago, finding that the Section 2 prohibitions on election discrimination would not prevent the state legislature there from imposing some restrictions on access to the polls, a decision written by Sam Alito at the time. We remember as well, just as late as this past term, a case coming out of Alabama. And that case, of course, finding that the Section 2 Voting Rights Act of the law of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 does, in fact, require that the legislature there provide and ensure that members of the black population in the state of Alabama there have access to the polls, establishing the requirement that there of the 7 congressional districts in that state, at least 2 of them be majority black districts. That a decision made by a divided majority of the Supreme Court, led by the Chief Justice and Associate Justice Brett Kavanaugh. And then we have this decision coming up in this term. It's a case called Alexander versus South Carolina NAACP. It has to do with the interface between voting rights and also race as a proxy for politics, and whether or not the decision in South Carolina, again, another state in our union, another decision made by the legislature there can be justified under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. That's pending before the Supreme Court right now. And whether or not the state legislature was using race as a proxy for politics when it made some decisions about the line drawing in that particular state. We've talked about that. We'll talk about that case again when it comes up. We recall the oral argument of not too long ago in which the Supreme Court, a very much divided Supreme Court, had differing views on whether or not Section 2, as it applied there in South Carolina, did prohibit what the South Carolina legislature was doing, mixing politics and race, and finding maybe or maybe not that the lines drawn in that particular case had to be overturned and sent back to the legislature. We know all of that's going on in the midst of this Eighth Circuit decision of just this past week. A lot of focus still to this day on voting rights in America appropriately. Need to continue the fight to ensure that the franchise is extended and supported and enforced for as many people as possible in our nation. Voting is an especially good thing. Restrictions to voting, not a good thing. because they tend to limit the number of people who can make representative government go in America. Lots of discussion these days about democracy, the future of our republic. It is all dependent on voting rights. Where do we get a president? Where do we get Supreme Court justices? Where do we get members of our Congress? Where do we get members of our state assembly and state senate? Where does the governor come from? Where do our local representatives, our county representatives, where do they come from? It's all by voting. If you want to change the world, if you want to change policy locally, statewide, you want to change our nation, it's through voting. That's why this issue remains so very important. That's why the decision coming out of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, the likely decision coming out of the Supreme Court, probably in June of next year, having to do with this case coming out of South Carolina, all of these looked at for guidance in terms of what the Voting Rights Act says and what it does not say, and the reliance that Americans can make on that statutory authority to ensure that the franchise is protected for people of all color and of all national origins, of all languages as well, also incorporated in the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Lots going on in the area of voting rights in America. Will continue to be focused on all of those kinds of cases. I promised at the start we'd also talk about voting in our own state here of Wisconsin. Yes, indeed, this major case, a lot of attention given to this case throughout the past several weeks and months. The case is Clark, C-L-A-R-K-E, versus Wisconsin Elections Commission. And yes, indeed, this major oral argument before our own state Supreme Court just this past Monday, November 21st. What is this case all about? You probably know a lot about it. Let's set some groundwork for it. The petitioners, the people who are seeking to have the present system of lines redrawn in the state of Wisconsin, initially asked the high court to take up the question whether the Wisconsin Constitution contains a prohibition against partisan gerrymandering here in the state of Wisconsin. But citing the very fact-intensive nature of this question presented by this Clark case, the high court instead granted review, which it can do in its discretion, on two principal issues. Number one was whether the current maps under which we vote right now and have voted in recent years and months violate what's called the contiguity requirement, whether the contiguous requirement contained in Article 4 of Section 4 and 5 of the Wisconsin Constitution requires that the present maps be redrawn. The contiguity requirement, whether that was invoked by this. And second, whether current maps were adopted in violation of Wisconsin's separation of powers principle, an issue that's also a part of this present appeal, probably less attention given to that by the court, but also a part of this case decided and being decided right now, the subject of oral argument just this past week. The Wisconsin Constitution, as we know, contains two requirements regarding district boundaries that are somewhat seemingly, superficially, at somewhat at odds. It says that the legislative districts shall be, quote, bounded by county, precinct, town, or ward lines. That's one provision of the Constitution. And also, the districts shall consist of contiguous territory. At the time the Constitution was written, it's fairly clear historically that all municipalities in the state were, in fact, contiguous, making it fairly easy to comply with both of those constitutionally affirmed directives in our principal guiding doctrine in the state of Wisconsin. In the decades that have followed since that time, however, the cities and villages have appropriately applied what are called their annexation powers, and those have basically diced up towns across the state in ways that created what are called municipal islands, quite literally spots, areas that are not contiguous to a major portion of the particular city or town. And those islands are portions of municipalities that could be geographically disconnected from the rest of the municipality to which they would otherwise belong. So we get these islands quite literally in the map as you look at it today. So that phenomenon is what gives rise to the principal argument before the Supreme Court in this Clark case, the subject of the oral argument just this past week. How do you draw maps that are both bounded by municipal lines and also contiguous, these two requirements in our state constitution? Now, for many years, the legislature and the courts resolve this seemingly important tension between those two concepts by saying that districts would be permitted to be politically contiguous, but not geographically contiguous, basically kind of siding in favor of the political contiguity argument, but not geographically contiguous. And that's what gives rise once again to the present piece of litigation. Under that particular approach, that historical approach, municipal islands may in fact be incorporated into a district if they are part of a municipality included in that district, even if they're not geographically connected to the rest of that district. And so that's kind of the principle that's guided us historically here in the state of Wisconsin. Now, the petitioners in this case, in the Clark case, now before the Wisconsin Supreme Court, have argued that political contiguity is insufficient, that contiguousness when it comes to politics is inadequate and inconsistent with our Constitution and to satisfying the contiguity requirement. They have argued instead that strict geographical contiguity is in fact required, and they contend that all the physical land area in a district must be connected, and that the current maps adopted again by the court, by the Supreme Court, after a dispute between the governor and the legislature last time around, are unconstitutional because they contain these municipal islands that are not geographically contiguous with those districts. And so the petitioners here in the Clark case are asking the court to strike down those maps as being inconsistent with our Constitution under this contiguity concept. Now, what do we know? What do we know about what happened this past Monday in terms of the oral argument? Once again, we've got a lot of dispute, plainly, among the Supreme Court justices. We know that there is a so-called 4-3 split, not always indicative of how courts resolve issues, but a 4-3 split sort of ideologically over time. The four justices on one side of the political aisle seemed ready to embrace an argument from the challengers in this case, this Clark case, that the maps do in fact violate the state constitution because they include more than 70 different districts, many of those including these so-called islands. And Wisconsin voters, as we know, elect 99 assembly members every 2 years, but only about half of the 33 members of our state Senate would normally be up for election next year. Much of the oral argument from this past week focused on how to interpret this contiguity requirement, this contiguity language in the Constitution. As I said, there's language in our Constitution that establishes that fairly clearly. Turns out that despite that requirement, 75 of the state's 132 legislative districts, 54 in the state assembly and 21 in the Senate, contain at least one of these detached pieces or these islands that are out there. So what do we know about what happened? Well, we know that Jill Karofsky, for example, talked about the tail leading the dog when there was an argument made about this annexation issue by some of the respondents. And she said, that's the tail leading the dog. I'm pretty sure we're supposed to look at the definition to determine what the law really is, she said. Justice Ann Walsh Bradley also said that history from the time of Wisconsin's Constitution led her to believe that it was unconvincing, that is her word, that contiguous could mean something other than physical contact. Interesting arguments being made. The attorney for the nonprofit Campaign Legal Center, who represented some of the challenges, also said it was possible to draw physically contiguous districts that included those detached portions. He said there's not a single place in Wisconsin where it's not possible to bound the districts within county and a town and ward lines, and to be 100 contiguous in those areas. Significantly, the court seemed to be somewhat unsettled on how they would proceed if indeed they find that these contiguous districts have to be acknowledged and that the maps have to be withdrawn. And as a part of the discussion here, they recognized that they've got a limitation. They've got some dates coming up here about voting in 2024. And when we come back after this brief break, we're going to talk more about that March 15th deadline, if you will, and more about what the Supreme Court on both sides of the political aisle had to say about the oral arguments of just this past week. Stay with us for that further discussion here on our Saturday morning broadcast. I know a place, say that you'll go.
The Shaw, W-A-U-K. As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
Maybe we'll have a cookie trade.
I like that idea. I like that a lot.
We'll eat them while we're on the show.
Because everyone loves listening to people on the radio eat.
Calvin, what's your favorite cookie?
Shout out to my mom's. She makes these sour cream cookies around Christmas time, and they're really good.
My mouth just watered.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Brock. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. The Devil's Advocates radio show.
Chris from Middleton. Welcome to the show. What do you got for us?
I'm a Democrat. I totally agree that there's been too much corporate influence probably in the Democratic Party. I liked how Bernie talked about economic issues, and I agree we need more of that. But I don't think we can also afford to shy away from the identity politics. In fact, we got to lean into the identity politics and not be shy about it.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show, weekday afternoons from 4 till 6 on your local Civic Media. This is The Shaw, WAUK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back. We're talking in this, our final segment of this first hour here on our Saturday morning broadcast about this very important decision, a voting decision, a gerrymandering decision, a line-drawing decision right now pending before our Wisconsin Supreme Court that entertained oral arguments. The way that you do this, you file briefs, you bring the case before the court, and you argue, not in a trial setting, but you argue to the court about the merits or demerits of an opposing position, the merits of your position. That's what happened just this past week, talking about the responses, at least from the bench, from our seven Supreme Court justices. Many of the justices scratching their heads about what they do. In fact, if there's a decision by a majority of the court, and we don't know that yet, we don't know what their decision has been or will be. Question is, what do you do if, in fact, you find this contiguity requirement does require that the lines be redrawn? Some of the justices asking all the lawyers in the case, what do we do? And asking specifically that they provide names of nonpartisan mapmakers who could serve as a special master to advise them as they resolve this issue about line drawings. The request signals certainly that at least some of the justices were aware of the need to move very quickly if they're going to strike down the particular lines under which we operate to this day. And indeed, an awful lot of state elections officials have said that it's March 15th of 2024. March 15th of 2024, we need a new map in place no later than that date for next year's elections to take place with some sense of organization and clarity. So we've got some weeks, a couple of months, if you will, to decide this case. The Supreme Court, again, entertaining this oral argument. Brian Hagedorn, a member of our Supreme Court, press the challengers in this case to explain how they should think about partisan fairness if the maps do in fact get redrawn. He suggested during the course of the oral argument there was no way for a court to determine whether there was an acceptable number of Republicans and Democratic districts. He's identifying this political issue that's out there along the way. The response came back from the challengers. When voters go and vote, the map should reflect how they voted, came back the response. Many of the questions from some of the justices also sharply pressed the question of why they had not raised their claims 2 years ago. And Justice Rebecca Bradley, specifically one of the members of our seven-member court, repeatedly noted that 2 years ago, no party had raised a contiguity challenge and had stipulated that all the districts complied with the court's definition of contiguity. There was a good deal of interruption back and forth among the justices, even between Justice Bradley and Justice Karofsky during the course of this oral argument. Along the way, we had the Chief Justice, Annette Ziegler, warn that a court decision waiting into redistricting would invite future challenges and would perhaps signal that there was no finality to rulings in redistricting cases. She said, "Is there any end to this litigation?" And she was focusing again upon the future. What does this hold if, in fact, we come back perhaps every time that there is a redrawn set of lines in our state and renewed set of litigation in our state? We go back and forth, and when does this come to an end? When does this all get some ultimate resolution? We don't know. We don't know what the answer to that question is, but some very, very contested, very, very much in the weeds, practical discussion among the justices and the parties advocating for and against the drawing of lines in the state of Wisconsin just this past week. Again, a decision pretty much needs to be made, needs to be rendered fairly soon, so that our elections officials, as we go into the all-important 2024 election year, have a chance not only to ensure that the ballots are accurately presented and printed for voting, but that all Americans in our state, all of those people who are entitled to vote, who should have that right to vote, have an access to understanding and information about where the lines are drawn. Who are our representatives now? What kinds of elections should we have in the coming series of elections, the campaigns coming up? All those things are going to dictate who the candidates are, where they're going to be campaigning. The line drawing, this issue is huge when it comes to voting. And of course, all of this has got to be compliant with the United States Constitution, in addition to our Wisconsin Constitution. And yes, indeed, consistent, as we have found out in the state of Wisconsin, with the Voting Rights Act as well. The Voting Rights Act of 1965, ensuring again, access to the polls according to color. Here we've got an allegation of partisan gerrymandering, which, again, the federal courts have said they're not involved in. But the basic principles about access to the polls continuing to animate this oral argument of this past week in front of our state Supreme Court. And now the Supreme Court soliciting information from the parties about what they should do next. It is no small task if indeed a majority finds that the lines need to be redrawn. How do you do that? Does the Supreme Court itself do that? The staff of the court? Do they hire somebody else, a special master, a cartographer, which we've seen in other cases in our country, a cartographer coming in and taking a look at all the demographics, all of the things that go into drawing those lines? What will happen next? We'll see what the court does. Could, in fact, issue some interim directives to the parties to this litigation about what they should do, asking for further briefing. That's a possibility as well. We don't know yet, but we do know that in the coming months, there needs to be a decision coming out of our state high court about the future of voting in our state that will certainly have an impact upon national voting and national elections as well. In that connection, we know that one of the candidates for the presidency in the United States of America, his name is Donald Trump, our former president, is also running again. And we also know that he himself is involved in more than a few pieces of litigation pending in the state and federal courts around our nation. We know, for example, that coming up in January, a little month before the coming month of December, mid-January, there's a second portion of the defamation lawsuits, the civil case that's been brought by E. Jean Carroll. Remember, she was one who alleged sexual assault by the former president way back in the 1990s. This is the damages portion of that case. That's coming up in January, in just a couple of months, a state civil court in New York. We know as well that the other principal state litigation also happening in New York, that's pending still in the court presided over by Justice Arthur Engoron. That's the state valuations case brought by the attorney general there. That case continues to be prosecuted civilly in that matter, continuing into the month of December as well. When we come back after the top of the hour, we're going to talk more about other pieces of litigation going on in other courts of our nation, and then talk about these issues related to the First Amendment and the implications, the interaction between those cases and someone, in this case, the defendant, who's running for the presidency of the United States of America. Stay with us for this second hour of our Saturday morning broadcast. That and more here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
Your home for the Devil's Advocates. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6. On The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight.
The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Eggland's Best.
I'm Stacey.